Welcome to the G&JB show. We're on episode number 48. Jack Bowen, how's life?
Yeah, it's not too bad. White Axe, how are you?
Are you calling me the White Axe again?
Yeah, I might as well. Well, Lottie was pretty happy with it, so we'll have to keep running with it.
Mate. Paul Miller, we introduced you to the show. How are you, mate?
Very, very well. What's White Axe?
Oh, here we go. No.
So it's every week we should get the guest to ask. It's Gareth's fight name.
It's irrelevant. It was just a joke, and these dickheads run with it.
It's good. Like I said last week, I try and get all the kids down the gym to call him the White Axe, but yes. Some of them won't take the bait. I tried yesterday as well, and no one wanted to do it. So.
And we move on. So Paul Miller, 2002 Commonwealth Games gold medalist. Were you the Australian captain as well?
No, that was David Turner.
David Turner.
Super heavyweight.
Super heavyweight, yes. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Very good guy.
Mate, great captain. There's a lot more to you than just the Commonwealth Games gold medal. Now you're a businessman, a family man. You spent time overseas. We want to know about Paul Miller from the start, where you were born, where you grew up, and let's take us into your life.
I'm Darwin born. Born in Darwin. My brothers and sisters, I've got four brothers, two sisters. My siblings were all born in Canberra, except for myself in Darwin, and then my younger brother in Alice Springs. And then we returned to Canberra, and I moved to Brisbane when I was in grade one, grade two. My family is a big swimming family. So my family is a big swimming family. So now I work in, it was almost inevitable, but I work in swimming. I have a learned a swim school. I have a couple of learned a swim schools that we operate. One at a little pool opposite Suncorp Stadium in Paddington, Ithaca Pool. And we have a swim centre, learner swim centre in Ascot. And I also have a boxing studio, not a boxing gym. That's for ahead. That's for maybe in my 50s. But for now, it's a boxing studio, boxing fitness classes.
That's excellent. Mate, were you ever going to be a swimmer growing up? Did you think that's where you were going?
There's six kids in our family. And I'm the slowest out of six. I'm a land creature. I'm not amphibious at all. So it wasn't a choice for me. I just wasn't that good at swimming. I think I made one state final in under 12s, and that's it.
So you did dabble with it, but realised it wasn't for you after a while.
Yeah, all of my family, we swam a lot. My brother was a national age swimming champion. He was in the Seoul development squad. Yep. My sister was a 800 meter age national champion, and then my next sister Gail, we both went to the Sydney Olympics. She was water polo. She won a gold medal playing water polo at the Sydney Olympics. And then I was boxing. I like exercising on the land. And then my two younger brothers were also much better at swimming than me, but they were football players.
Football as in?
Rugby union.
Rugby union.
Yeah, so my younger brother, Steve, the one directly below me, he played professional rugby in Ireland. And then my youngest brother, Chris, who was probably the athlete out of all of us, he had three knee reconstructions before 21. So he was done pretty early with rugby. He works in fitness now. But we all went our different paths. Had my older brother was swimming, and then he played 10 years of first grade rugby in Sydney and Brisbane.
Yeah, nice.
And then, we all went our different paths.
So when you said you moved to Brisbane in grade one, where was school? Where was primary school? Where was high school? When did boxing start? That sort of stuff.
We left Canberra, and I didn't do grade one. I started in grade two in Brisbane at St. Finbar's in Ashgrove. Mm-hmm. And my family, we all lived over on the other side of town. So we were in Cooperoo, Holland Park, that area. And we swam at Stones Corner at Langlands Park MLC Leander. Joe King was the coach there. And my dad was an assistant swimming coach, was a swim coach, assistant under Joe King. And, I used to catch... And then we moved to this might be this is a might be too much detail.
Definitely not.
But we had a we had a shoe shop business, and we had 8 or 9 different shoe stores around Brisbane, in Inala, Cleveland, all over Brisbane.
Wow.
And we things just didn't work out, and that business went belly up. And so we lost everything, and the family, the 6 kids and mum and dad, 8 of us moved into a 2-bedroom unit above a chicken shop on Stanley Street in Woolloongabba. And so 4 of us, my 2 sisters, my older brother, who was in year 12, and myself were in 1 bedroom. And then my mum and dad and my youngest brother were in the other bedroom. And then in the corridor in front of the toilet was my younger brother, between, you know, my second youngest brother. Yeah, we lived there for 18 months to avoid, you know, it was catastrophe, but it was the greatest 18 months. You know, we just loved it. And we explored around Mater Hospital. We used to climb through the back of buildings and on the roofs of buildings. And we'd go fishing in the Brisbane River, and just had the greatest 18 months. And then we moved into a house in Kangaroo Point. We'd lost everything, but we'd just avoided bankruptcy.
So when you said you loved it, I'm guessing the kids loved it. The parents were stressed.
They must have been beyond stressed. I cannot imagine it. But, you know, in our house, there's 6 kids. So we always had, you know, mum, dad, they just gave us so much. They were full-time taxi service, driving us to sport, football and water polo and swimming. We weren't much of a cricket family or that sort of stuff. My sister's netball. But when we lived at Kangaroo Point, the boys, myself and my 2 young brothers, the 3 of us, we were mischief makers. You know, we were running around all around Woolloongabba and climbing through the Mater Hospital. We'd go and play tennis on the tennis courts at St. Lawrence is the school up there. But we're fishing in the Brisbane
River.
Where I went. Is that where you went?
Yeah, it's Jack's school.
I know the tennis courts, but they were in Somerville House.
Oh, yes, Somerville. Court. Yes,
oh, no, there was some there may on have lorries been some, on the yeah. oval.
Oh, yes,
on,
yes.
On the field, yeah.
I think we might have been the Somerville House ones. Yeah. But we would explore all through the school grounds and, yeah. And then, yeah, we're fishing under the Story Bridge and... don't know what the name of the suburb is, but just back from the Story Bridge and around the bend of the river, and we're fishing at the Kangaroo Point Cliffs. 13 out of 14 days of school holidays where they're fishing, we'd bring friends, and we just had, it was the greatest.
Were you catching much fish there?
At the time, we'd catch some heavier, some solid catfish, and some bream and Moses perch and... this and that. Eels.
No sharks,
lots of eels. No sharks. But now, actually, coincidentally, about 10 weeks ago, my son and I, we bought some game reels and rods, and we've been fishing maybe 8 or 9 visits. Our goal is to catch something over a meter in the river. So far, we're halfway there. We caught 50-centimeter tailor, and we caught a 46-centimeter tailor yesterday. We're catching some stuff. We're catching plenty of stuff. The river is really clean. There's big thread fin salmon. We had to pull our baits out the other day because the dolphins, a big pod of dolphins, wouldn't move past when we were fishing at the Story Bridge.
Really?
The water's clean. It's cleaner than it was 20 years ago, I'd say.
Yeah, wow. So from your probably 18 months of your parents' worst time of their life, it was just great fun.
No, we loved it. And at the time, it's gone now, but at the time there was a model shop across the road. They saw model airplanes and tanks and battleships, and we were mad and spend every spare cent we had buying models and building them in the bedrooms. And yeah, we just had a great time. And the rule was, when you went to a friend's house or if you got dropped home, you just get dropped off on the street or at the lights across the road, or you don't invite anyone in. And
yeah, right.
Yeah. We had a great time there, and then we moved to a house in Kangaroo Point, and we absolutely loved it. You know, we loved Kangaroo Point and all that point, running around there.
Where'd you go to high school?
I went to St. Lawrence's main rival.
Ashgrove.
Yes.
Maris Brothers.
Yes.
Oh. That's where I'm.
Do I have to referee? No, this?
That's the big AIC rivalries Maris Brothers and Lorries. Like if you're playing union or volleyball or cricket, that's the one all the boys turn up.
Oh, it is. Yeah, big crowds. Yes.
Yeah, it's massive.
I was the person leading the chants. I was the war cry. I was the cheerleader. I wasn't the I didn't play in the first 15. I was boxing.
I was with you.
Yeah. So I won nationals. First year I won nationals was in year 12. But I was the school captain that year at Ashgrove.
Yeah, wow.
And so I was the war cry leader.
Lucky I wasn't at Laurie's when Paul was there. He would have punched me up.
Yeah. Well, I have no doubt.
I think that's facetious. That's being kind. I think the other way, actually. Yeah.
Mate, so you won your first national title when you're in
year 12.
How'd you find doing grade 12 and being one of the boys at Maris and then juggling boxing? Because
it gave me so much. It gave me so much. It just gave me a different perspective. Or we had a big PNG population, Papua New Guinean boys at Ashgrove, which was just so special and just fantastic. But boxing, I was hanging out with, indigenous fellas and Lebanese fellas and, from Burma and Indian, and just gave me a mix of a greater diversity, and it made me a different person. You know, boxing was just so great, and I was, you would see people that were just not from the private school circle. It was bloody good for me.
When did you start boxing and why?
I started when I was 13 years old. I got dropped in our team, in our family. Everyone was good at everything that they did, sort of thing. And I got put in the B team because I was a real little late developer. I was just rocking a little bit.
You can take that off if you want.
There you go.
Sorry about that. A bit easier.
Yeah, and sorry, I could just hear that rattling there. Sorry. Yeah. And I got put in the B team, and it was very just a humbling experience. I'd always been this, really good junior rugby player through the age groups, and my older brother and my dad said, "Why don't you do boxing and get really, big and strong and come back the next year?" And anyone that knows boxing, you don't get big and strong, yet small and strong. Yeah. You don't get big. It's not going to help you bulk up for football. But I did that. And I just went to, I just happened to walk into Fortitude Valley PCYC, where Steve Deller was the coach, and Steve and Ted was his assistant coach, and just two great guys, great men. Who knew boxing really well. And Steve, I had a number of boxing coaches, the way it turned out. Just the way the dominoes fell, I had a number of boxing coaches. And Steve Della, he put the foundation there. He built the foundation. And then everything else was just shaving off that edge or adding this. And all of the coaches that I had, to some degree, maybe save one, but all of them contributed. And it was great to, I learned so much of all of them. All of them had different impacts on how I developed and evolved as a boxer. So I was training at Fortitude Valley, and at the same time that I walked in, within a matter of weeks, another fellow walked in named Luke Meldon.
Oh, yeah.
And And there was this little kid there who was just wild little fella named Greg Eady. And he was, and so it just so happened that we grew up in the Fortitude Valley. And I would catch two buses. I would finish school, walk really quickly to the bus stop, catch a bus into the city, and then one into Fortitude Valley. And if I was really lucky, I got a certain number bus that took you straight to the valley. And then I would walk down Wickham Terrace to Fortitude, to the PCYC there. And sometimes when I was at the when I was living in Kangaroo Point, I would run across the bridge to go home or to go to training. I got great memories running over the bridge. And I remember there was always, you know, there was a police station, water police station there where the Howard Smith Wharves are, and there was a couple of indentations on the roof that were, I'm not sure if it was stories or folk tales, but I think it was people jumping off.
Really?
I don't know. I always thought it, and I always run across and see these divots in the police station roof.
So did Greg Edie, was he on the same side as you in the Manchester Games? He was in that squad too,
yes,
wasn't he?
Yes, he was, yes.
What a journey together.
Yes, yeah, we went from the start right through, yeah.
So when did you have your first fight?
So I trained for probably a year before I had a bout. So I was real physically strong. I was little. I think I started when I was 46 kilograms, 47 kilograms. So I was a little dude. But I was physically, I was just strong. I wish now, with hindsight, my brothers and I, we wrestled with each other and we were just physically strong, you know, with rugby training. I remember one age group, I forget what, the coach would give the ball and say to the team to get the ball off me. I'd always get the ball, you know, I was just strong on that sort of things. But, when I started boxing, I started because I'd been put in the B team at school. And so I just went into it that way. And then 2 years later, in the under 15s, I made it into the A team. And that was the last year I played football. Actually, I played club in under 16s and then I was done with it.
So you did get back into the A team. It worked.
I did. In the under 15s, I did. Yeah, under 15, I made the A team at the school rugby team. And then I played club under 16. And I just never got back into it. I'd got the bug by then, you know.
Halfback, 5'8"?
I was breakaway.
All right.
And I had a little dabble at hooker, a little dabble at halfback. Yeah, but mostly just breakaway, flanker.
So, from your early boxing days, obviously things started to develop, you moved on. When did you think, this is my sport, I can do something with this? Or did you actually ever have that feeling?
I think even in year 11 and 12, I was boxing with men often, like sparring with men, and I was good. I was more than holding my own with professional, you know, state champions and stuff. And in year 12, I fought at the Nationals, and I think I fought Lawrence Tuasa in the final. Yep. Great fella, great dude. And then I think the following year he won New South Wales Senior Middleweight Championships. I think it was the following year, and I had that year out of sport because I'd developed stress fractures in my back. But by that stage, you get to know it. Even if you're a junior, if you're boxing against other people, you get a feeling of how good you are, or if you're holding your own or whatnot. I thought by year 12 I was national champion, and that was the first, 95, 96, I started thinking, you know, maybe the Olympics are not out of reach in 2000. I mean, I hadn't even won a senior title then, so that's early. Probably 97. I lost in the final at Nationals to Hosking.
Daniel Hosking.
Daniel.
Is it Daniel?
Lyndon Hosking.
Oh, Lyndon Hosking, yeah.
I lost in the final to Lyndon Hosking, and I got out of the ring and I felt, you know, as everyone does, that won the bout pretty well. But I knew that I was at that level by then, and he was a good, you know, relatively successful international amateur level guy, and I thought, oh, I can be that level easily, you know.
No, I'm just shocked how similar Paul's story is to mine.
Yeah,
like it's very like same kind of school, exactly the same. I feel just how we both fell in love with boxing. It's awesome to hear. I'm just sitting here enjoying this, soaking it up.
I know Jack's got about 35 questions to ask you, and that's why I threw it to Jack then, because I'm thinking this is where you take over.
Yeah, when did you think? Yeah, I know we've said when did you think you could make it, but what were some of the names around then that you were competing against? Maybe some rivalries or some people you were looking at, thinking I need to fight that person soon.
I remember I went to nationals in Hobart in 1995 as a junior. And in that Queensland senior team, there was all these guys, and I'm gonna feel like I've let them down by not mentioning. I've got a vision of a couple of senior boxers that were just really tough, competent, you know, domestic level, but high standard guys. But we also had Richie Rowles and Robbie Peden in that Queensland team, and they were. They were real, really good, very generous mentors. You know, they weren't. Robbie Peden. He made a point of just he sort of got around. It's a good example to set. You know, he got around amongst the team, and he was quite generous with, you know, offering encouragement. And the culture in the Queensland team, and I'm sure it still persists. It was just a really good. That was with Alan Nicholson and Pat and. It's just a really good culture of age groups intermingling and in cheering. And yeah, I know, but 95 was that I saw the guys in the Atlanta tracksuits. That's following. That was 96, right? Atlanta.
Yeah, 96 Atlanta.
Yeah, so yeah. The guys were in the tracksuits from 92, Barcelona tracksuits. Yes. I just saw guys in uniforms and those tracksuits. And you see, there was another, some guy from Tasmania, Trent. Anyway, a whole bunch of guys run around in the Australian national team tracksuits. You know, they're like the top tier. Mm. And then when you get to that level, you realise that they're the bottom tier of the international level. But yeah. It's stages, right? You can't build a pyramid without the first little block, and you make the state team, or you win the regional, the Wide Bay titles, whatever it is, and then you win the Queensland title and you win the nationals. It's incremental. You can't go straight to the top. That's not how it works. But seeing these top senior guys, yeah, that I think 96 I had almost a year out of the sport because I had stress fractures in my back, but I was still training, and I was not sparring, not boxing, but I was in it, you know, around the sport. And then I had a fight back in Townsville against the person I'm trying to find my blue books so I can find.
Yeah.
I've got an idea for a TV show, a documentary actually, which involves. I had 110 or so amateur fights. How's this for a TV idea, a documentary, a movie? Get the blue book and you try to find every single person in the blue book, and you travel to Kazakhstan, and you travel to the US, and you travel to Turkey, and you meet all these people, and you see where they are in life and how they've evolved. And that would be what a great maybe a 1 or 2 year affair to get that done really, really well.
That'd be so good. That'd be such a mission too.
Yeah, and to find guys that have, you know, like maybe they've done really well in life, or maybe they're not doing so well, and maybe they remember the fight, or they have no recollection of you whatsoever because you were.
And some, quite possibly, might not be there either.
Yeah,
yeah,
that would be a cool idea. I've got that percolating in my mind for a TV show or for a movie idea, but with the my main rivals, it just seemed to be that. I had a lot of sparring with a lot of guys, and it's hard not to sound like an idiot with this, but I always felt like there was a couple of guys that I always felt like I went well in sparring. I was always looking for, I never felt out of my depth ever, you know? I'd have a sparring session and I got hurt in sparring. But I always felt like if I got a second chance, I always redeemed it. Once I'd had a feel of anyone, I felt like I could work it all out.
Was that just an attitude adjustment, or was it like, okay, I've worked him out this time. He got the better of me, but now it won't happen again. Like, what
I'm
was
not
it?
Sure. I was good at I was good at working things out. But in terms of, like being in a boxing ring and having the experience, oh, I'm in way over my head. I ended up being in the ring with an Olympic gold medalist and Olympic silver medalist and world champion, and I never had that experience. You know, I had, that's not to say I didn't get hammered at certain times, but I always felt like, oh, you know, I can handle that person on another day.
So you were never overwhelmed?
No, I never.
By your opponents?
No, and that's funny, you know, because, and you see it in boxing. You see your peers and your friends achieve these great heights, like Danny Green just did so incredibly well, and Daniel Gill, just really happy for him. Just wanted him to just—he just did it. He just achieved, and just a fella from Tasmania just achieved greatness. You know,
did it the hard way. Going to
did it the hard
Germany
way.
Too.
Oh my gosh.
No one at that time was winning in Germany.
He's in the conversation for, greatest. You know, to do that twice, just incredible accomplishments. And then Jamie Pittman, and he didn't have necessarily, he wasn't world champion in the professionals, but he challenged for a world title. Michael Katsidis, to see him, you know, at the highest standard of the sport, you know, in Las Vegas or Mantle, wherever it was, Las Vegas. And so I had that probably frustrating experience with hindsight on reflection that I had the, you know, comparable physical, athletic, potential, perhaps better boxing skills or comparable boxing skills, perhaps same level power, but just didn't work out, didn't do it, didn't make that accomplishment, didn't make those achievements quite the same, you know?
I think I've said to you quite a few times, Jack, on the way up, that I still class you as the best technical boxer I've seen come from Australia. I just thought you were very smart, very intelligent in the boxing ring.
Yeah, that's generous. I think Daniel Gill was also... separate to his superb conditioning, was technically just savvy and smart and a technician, but in a real understated, unobvious way. You know, I remember when Costa Zoo used to fight, and after every fight, you'd always hear these guys say, "It just wasn't my night. I was just off tonight." And I also remember lots of times having fights, and then after people saying, "Oh, I just didn't feel right tonight," but that's because you make the distance a bit unusual, and you just change all the what's normal is just a little bit different. Felt like the people that say, "I just had an off night," that can happen, definitely. But often the off night was manipulated, was constructed by the opponent.
And that was part of your plan? Was it in your head at that time, "I have to adjust so this guy can't do certain things"? Like,
well, I had a little secret thing that I never told my teammates. I didn't tell my best friends. I didn't tell anyone. But I had this thing where, if I got hurt, I would focus on being fast and awkward. And so often after I got hurt, I hurt opponents, just from being a bit different, not necessarily covering up, but just being a little bit focused on being fast. Because, you know, as soon as you try to hit hard or you get desperate, everything slows down, and that's when it gets easier for your opponent. But if I get a little bit hurt, I would just try to be very fast and just change how I normally was, just be a little bit more awkward or sit back a little bit more or sit in a little bit more, whatever it may be. And that pulled me through trouble on any number of occasions, you know. That's a hard thing to coach. I think an experienced person would understand what it means, but a beginner boxer, you wouldn't say that to them because it doesn't make any sense. But I think focusing on being fast and just slightly awkward, not necessarily more aggressive, not necessarily more defensive, but just changing the pattern of who you were, and all of a sudden you get hurt a little bit and you just make it a little bit different. makes it, gets you out of trouble a lot, I think.
Yeah, I like the way you're thinking there. It's good to see, but when you're talking about awkward, certain Australian fighters are flicking through my mind as well. There was no more awkward than Jeff Horn.
And so awkward.
Look how far Jeff went. That's
so awkward.
Amazing.
You know, he just achieved so much. And you know what? He was awkward. And you know, even when he fought Crawford.
Yes.
And when he fought Crawford, he wasn't, you know, Crawford is just, for me, he was the best at the time. I'm still not sure that he's not the best ahead of all the others. I think he's just old school 1980s, you know, Fantastic Four, Magnificent Four group, like Hearns, Hagler, Leonard, that Duran, that level. But he was still awkward and he's still catching Crawford. Strange.
And I remember, but people talk about his Manny Pacquiao win, and look, a lot of people complain, but I can't complain. He won that fight in my mind.
It's the best, I think, of any single performance.
Yeah, I agree.
I don't think you can, you know, and there's conditions, there's qualifications for it. You know, Pacquiao was old. He might have underestimated him. Yes. Or agreed. But Pacquiao still went on to greatness. If that was, if you know what, if he had fizzled after, if he had faded after that, then all of those, not criticisms, but qualifications might be valid. But yeah, they're not, because he didn't fade. He went
he
on
beat
to
Keith Thurman, like, yes, like a fight or two after that.
Yeah, he kicked on and kept going.
And dropped him. But like, he was, yeah, he's
also that fight with Jeff, though, he was awkward. We're talking about his awkwardness.
Mm.
He also went the furthest at the Olympic Games since Spike Chaney won a gold medal, silver medal. Sorry, Jeff got the quarterfinals in
top eight,
2012.
But out of that team, though, when it first come out, I never thought he'd be the one that went the furthest. We had Damian Hooper, Cameron Hammond, Luke Jackson, the Maloneys, one of the Maloneys, Andrew, I think maybe. Like, that's a big list, and he went the furthest.
I like those guys, the Maloneys. I like them. Yeah, you can't not like them.
Mm. They've been down the gym sparring. I haven't been able to make it, but Gareth's been here. And
yeah, they've been sparring a couple of guys at the gym. Andy and Jason will both get big fights coming up. I won't say anything because I don't know if they're released. But very good guys. Always been true professionals since probably 16 years old. Like, they've just lived the life, and money's never been an issue.
Yeah.
Obviously, now money's part of the deal.
Yeah.
I like those guys too. They're good boys.
Talking about 2012 and stuff, a lot of those boys were in the Australian Institute of Sport and were based there. And were you one of the first?
I was the first
that got. Oh, okay. Yep.
There was scholarship holders prior to me. I think Robbie Peden was. There was scholarship holders, but I was the first live full time at the Institute of Sport in boxing. And I was with. It was just me and Bodo Andreas, one on one.
Was it just the two of you at the first?
Yes, yes. And no one else was really that keen because, yeah, he was challenging on some levels. There was no other. So it was just me full time with the coach, because I had a complicated coaching situation at the Gold Coast. I won't go into details, but this guy wanted me to sign a professional contract in the lead up to the Sydney Olympics. And it was a whole stack of cash. I probably should have done it. Yeah. But I thought, you know what, I'm going to win a medal at the Olympics. And I shouldn't sign that. Anyway, he insisted, and he was just unhappy with me. And I went down to the Institute of Sport, and I stayed there until the Olympics. I never came back, never said farewell to the coach. Never thanked him for the 12 months of training I'd been doing with him. But it was the gym that I had moved to. It was the environment. It was a lot of really good fighters in that gym. It was a lot of good fighters in the gym, and that's what I'd moved into, that gym, not necessarily to go under that tutelage of that coach.
Yeah.
And before him, I had trained with Shane Knox, and I think I had Steve Deller. just very good basics and just very good basics. And then I had, not through my choice, Steve had a job opportunity and he moved out to another place, a country town, Queensland town, to run a pub. And Shane Knox became my coach. He just assumed the Valley head coach position and I trained under him. And he gave me my single best weapon in boxing, which was my jab. Up until that point, I had won the junior nationals and I had sparred with Richie Rells, for instance, and an Olympian, and I felt like I was at that level already. I felt like I could more than handle that, but I had not developed a jab. And Shane Knox came in and he was just constantly on at me about this jab and pumping the jab, and it wasn't up my bag of tricks, wasn't up my alley. I just liked throwing this hard left hand. I had lots of success with it. And I used my right hand, but not even at 20-30% of what... By the time I finished and I left Shane Knox, I was much more difficult proposition for everyone. He'd put this thing on me that I hadn't had before. And so I won 1998 Australian Championships and I was best boxer at the tournament. And that was just under a year and a half, two years with Shane Knox, and he'd implemented that tool.
That's interesting about Noxie, because Noxie is known, if you didn't watch his boxing career, he's known for his power shot, his big right hand, the hammer.
Yes. For his big right hand, I thought he had a left hook.
Was he left?
I think left hook. But, you know, I remember a video of him knocking out this Japanese. I think he might have been number one contender in the world, number two. And he knocked him out in about 30 seconds. And I know I'm going to get this wrong, but I think it was a left hook. But regardless, Shane was just mad about jab.
And
it changed me. It was a huge influence.
Yeah.
You know, you get a mark on you from each fight, and you get a scar or whatever, and you get a stain from each coach, and that was his was really important. Better, you know, huge influence on how all my success thereafter. I had this excellent balance, had excellent basics from Steve Della, built it, but then I had this little, you know, in the computer games where you pick up weapons, I picked up this thing called a jab. This very good weapon that I hadn't really paid any attention to before.
Such a big thing too, being a southpaw yourself. Like, you know, you talk about Shane's left hook or if it was a right hand or whatever, but he wouldn't be able to set that up without a good jab and establish it.
Generally, it was Shane's power that people... I remember he always just... He'd say to me, if I was in the fight in the last round, I was always a chance.
Yeah.
Like... crazy.
And tough, like I've heard stories of him training hard, and I think that was the culture, you know, Jeff Fenwick just training hard.
Yeah.
Can we go back a bit? What was your time like when you first went to the AIS? What did the training program look like? What was the structure like? And
I was, at first I went there with a talent camp in 1995, and in that talent camp there was Chris Hamilton, Dallas Costello, I'm thinking of this guy, Shane Braslin. Anyway, there's a whole bunch of Lawrence Tuasa, a whole bunch of top juniors all around the country. And Jeff Fenwick popped into the camp, and that was prior to Coach Bodo Andreas turning up. And then I think he came in on 96. I think he came along 96 or 97. Anyway, 97, I was in this development camps, and I had a trip overseas, or a trip or two overseas, but there was 3-month camps at the Institute, and I think I was in on one of those. And then 98 similar, 99 it was three or four months in 98, and then it was a little bit more in 99. And then in 2000, I had this weird coach situation where I was just getting this pressure to sign this contract, and I wasn't willing to. And I flew down to Canberra, and I never returned, never thanked that fella, never spoke to him again.
Can I just jump in there? That contract, you don't have to tell me dollars, but in hindsight, would it have been more than you did earn in your professional boxing career if you'd have jumped on that deal?
Yes. Yep.
Yeah, right.
No, well, I earned 60, 65, 70% of that just with making the Olympics and the right. and the Commonwealth yes. Games and that. But also that's so and the Commonwealth Games. So you know, I'd probably made close to half of that just by following the Olympics with amateur. Yeah, the amateurs was just I was living in, you know, we would meet for the the team would go overseas and I was living at the Institute and I just had very little money. You know, it was tight conditions and I was working at the Institute and that sort of helped me get by. But I coached, we were talking about Daniel Gill coming up and I said, yeah, I think he's, I thought that I was the best in the country on any weight division and I thought that he was the second best, if not as good as me at the time, but he was younger than me. And he agreed to come in to leave. He had an excellent coach down in Tasmania and I just, again, I'm doing a disservice by not remembering, but I don't think he was that excited about Daniel coming to Canberra. And there was some misgivings and a lot of persuasion to happen. Anyway, Geely came. And then there was two other spots. So we're going to have four full-time live-in scholarship. And it was Jared Fletcher and Greg Eady. And we were the first four original living there full-time. It was me at first and then Geely. And then Greg Eady and Jared Fletcher were just relatively unestablished. They were babies coming through with mountains of potential, but juniors, you know, like young guys coming through. And so then it was the four of us. And we went to the, not the Nationals, but it was the Australian selection trials for, I think it might have been the Commonwealth Games, and all four of us won our places in the team.
Mate. When you I can't get over just you and Bodo being in camp together.
Yeah, it was.
That must have been rough for yeah. both of you because Bodo had just come from South Africa
yes,
at
South
the time,
Africa,
where
Nigeria,
he had real success.
South Africa, yes.
And then he's got one athlete. And for
yes,
you.
Yes, he worked with multiple. He had camps, like that'd be a,
oh, right,
be a
yeah.
10-week camp, multiple athletes. But then that was all through 98. He had all, you know, I was way down on the list. No, 97, sorry. 98 I won nationals and I was, you know, won the Arthur Tunstall yeah. cup thing. And then 99 I was that was when I started to, you know, won the Liverpool cup and I lost to Ukraine at the World Championships, but I had lost 7-4 and it was tight and I'd beaten Mexico in the earlier rounds and you know, I had a win over the USA among four fights in that tournament in the Liverpool Cup. But 99 I was really I felt as established. I was still young, definitely, but that was when I was spending more time at the Institute of Sport and struggling with the situation at the Gold Coast. And then I just ended up staying there in the lead up to the Sydney Olympics just because I hadn't had the coaching issue resolved. And I went to the Olympics never having thank that coach for his work over the last 18 months, whatever it may have been. And then 2001, I moved there full time.
You've mentioned that never thanking the coach.
Yeah.
It sounds like, is that a regret?
No, I just never saw him.
Oh, right.
I never saw him again. And
you didn't reach out?
Fella.
He didn't reach out?
No, he didn't reach out. He was pretty cranky with me for not signing that professional offer.
Yeah, right.
And we just never communicated ever again. He moved into state, went back to Victoria, I think, and just played out that way. And I've spoken with his former wife, his ex-wife, just this really lovely lady. She was a celebrant at a wedding that I went to, and she's just so great. And I said, oh, I never really spoke to him about that. And she said, oh, don't worry, it's fine. It's, you know, it's water under the bridge. Never spoke to him and never seen him since.
Amazing.
Yeah, going back, what did your training look like, Paul, when you were at the AIS? What was there, a strict running program? What was
yeah,
the,
I think we did. You know, I've got, I'm interested in this topic because I saw Tara Moana yes. running five 1,200 meter efforts just yeah. recently. Four? Four? Yeah.
Four. Yeah.
fascinating, and that's amazing. That's a big guy doing some mileage. At the time, we had a lot of running at the Institute of Sport, and the super heavyweight would do the same running as the light fly. And that doesn't make sense to me. I feel like every athlete now as I'm older and more educated and experienced, and I think that every athlete has a different program or requires a different program. I think but then again, you know, you see Tyson Fury doing these big long runs, and you've got to have stamina. The super heavyweight's doing 12 rounds just like the light flyweight is doing 12 rounds. But you know, running, doing 5 2-kilometer efforts on the track at the Institute of Sport, fine for the little dudes, but for the big heavyweights and stuff, it's pretty destructive. And I was very fragile. I was in the wrong sport in terms of I was strong, but I was often getting injured. And I think about just doing a lot of hard running, and often we had one training camp, and I'm sure of this. One of my old teammates might know better, but it wasn't 4 sessions a week. I think there was one camp where it was 4 sessions a day. I think it was one training camp where it was 5 sessions a day. And I was breaking down. I got my tonsils out just before the Olympics, but up until that point, I was getting sick every 3-4 weeks, like a cycle. And then we went down to 3 sessions a day, and then ultimately we returned to 2 sessions a day, and I could survive. But I was often sick or injured, and the overtraining, I always performed better a little bit underdone rather than overdone, and I had a lot of forced tapers because I had, you know, I had broken ribs at the Olympic trials. I had a lot of injuries, and that was a forced taper, and it, you know, turned up at the competition probably having done a whole lot less work. But I was a hard trainer. I always trained very hard, so that, you know, that carrying an injury and the forced taper was good for me, you know. But there's some guys like Justin Kane, just a cyclone, indestructible. They could handle volume, could train unstoppable. But I think each athlete is slightly different. Some athletes will need a 3 or 5 day taper. Some athletes will need sparring, you know, 2 days out. I think everyone's different, and then there's a lot to, it's a alchemist, it's a formula maker for the coach, saying this guy he works better if I've prepared him a little bit harder than this guy, and this guy needs an earlier taper. But then there's the weight consideration as well. There's a whole lot that goes into it,
and it takes time to work that out too.
Yeah,
you know, like time with different athletes, and you love the 1200s, don't you, Jack?
Yeah, not really, but I feel that'd be a bit conflicting too. You know, if you've got a group of 10, let's say, and one guy's doing half the effort you're doing, and you're busting your balls, I could imagine that would cause a bit of friction. And you're all living together. I could imagine that would be a bit like you're not working as hard as me.
Maybe I definitely, but if you're a team and you're teammates, but what? I'm just thinking, I don't care about anyone else, even my best mate in the team. That's, I'm just worried about what am I doing at this competition. I don't care if that guy's doing this or doing that.
Yeah, I understand that. Yeah.
I think it's
sure.
Interesting. Yeah, someone's saying, why is that guy getting a bludge? But I'd be thinking, geez, that poor fellow, I hope he's prepped well enough. I'm doing the work or whatever. I remember we had blood tests when we're living in when we're staying in Colorado Springs at the US Olympic Training Center. And they would tap our ears or our fingers, and they could tell from the amino acid or protein or some sort of how much damage you had from the previous day, where you were with recovery. And they'd do a tap on the finger and say, "Oh, you're not doing that. You're not doing the."
Is that a blood reading?
Blood reading.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, I remember we did that. The QAS.
Yeah.
We're doing that too. Yes.
And they did that in Colorado, and we had a physiologist there, Hamilton Lee, really just a great person, great dude. And he said, "You're not doing the track work today. You went too hard yesterday. You're too wrecked." I said, "Bullshit. I am definitely doing the track work." He said, "No, you're not." And we would have arguments because we wanted to train hard. We didn't want to miss the session, you know. But they said, no, you're too damaged from what we're reading. You're overdone from yesterday or whatever it was.
Were they flying people in too when you were in camp, like for comp sparring and when you were in at the AIS, was there comp sparring? Was there?
No, I was going around to local Canberra gyms.
Oh, true. Yep. Okay.
I sparred with Michael Ninnis, who became the heavyweight representative at the 2002. Just a great guy, champion boxer, just a champion dude. I sparred with Lovelock, Adam Lovelock, yeah. Great guy. Mm-hmm. Sparred with him. Sparred with Jared Omani, Brown Enyi, sorts of dudes in Canberra. Like just bustling. Little boxing community. Not much sparring, but we would drive to Sydney. Oh, we drove to Sydney often for sparring.
Okay.
Often.
So who were you working with back then? Let's say you're in Sydney for a weekend. Who would you work
in
with?
In Sydney, whoever you could find.
Billy Usain would have had a lot of guys around then, wouldn't he?
Billy Usain would have had a lot of guys, yeah. I was working with Greeny a lot. Yep. I sparred with Greeny a lot. Mm. A lot. We sparred a lot in the lead up to Sydney. And we sparred a lot even when I was in Canberra. I would drive up and spar with him a lot. And Sakio Bicker had stayed after the Sydney Olympics. I sparred with him a lot. That's a guy that just grew an arm and a leg and another three arms. At the end of Sydney Olympics, he was a really good fighter. But I remember sparring him and thinking that he was strong, but I always felt in command. I always felt like I just had his measure. And then over the next 3 or 4 or 5 years, and then I would get in with him and sparring at Rockdale, where it was very hot on the top floor and they liked having the windows closed. It was just masochistic, and sparring with Sakio, and he had started to get on top of me, and I was like, I thought I just knew how to handle him, and just a very hard guy and tough, and interesting.
Man, you've mixed it with some elite competition too. That's some massive names you've listed.
My hardest guy in sparring ever. I got hurt a couple of times in training, just a handful of occasions. But the hardest guy the most difficult guy that I ever sparred, was Sam Solomon.
Really?
Yes. Yeah. Only in terms of he did not feel fast. He did not feel strong. He didn't feel tricky. I always felt like I was just really in command in the ring, but I'd get out 8 rounds later. Jeez, that was awkward. And you know, you always hear guys, I think we said this just before we started, guys would fight Costazu and they'd get out and say, just wasn't my day, everything just was off. But that was because of his subtle nuance and skill. And yeah, Sam Solomon was not fast, was not strong, was not, wasn't out thinking me, but he was just excellent. And awkward and tough, and I liked him. I liked him a lot, and a champion guy, just a great person. I love seeing him do so well. It was awesome.
He's also a great advocate for never give up. He was in his 40s when he won the IBF world title, I think.
Crazy, yeah.
Like by that time, and his record wasn't the best, was it? Mm. He had quite a few losses on the way up,
and that actually opened a few doors for him, I'd imagine.
Yeah,
you know, they said, "Well, just get that guy. He can't hit hard.
We'll
get a defense. He's in the top 10. We'll get a defense." Then all of a sudden, he's given Winky Wright, you know, grandmaster boxer, giving him nightmares. A whole bunch of guys. Winky Wright, who was just killer. And he had a nightmare with Sam Solomon.
Yeah.
And Mundine had two or three.
I think they ended up having three fights. Yeah.
I was a huge fan of Sam Solomon. I just thought he was excellent. He had some intangible weirdness, an X factor that was not, never understood it.
And a gentleman, like you said, because I fought on his undercard March 19th last year.
Oh, yeah, he's still going last year.
Just a lovely guy, yeah. Let's go back to the Commonwealth Games, Paul. Mm. What was that experience like for you and winning the gold medal?
you know, how it played out was that it became this defining achievement for my career. I can't say, I mean, I won a silver medal at the Goodwill Games, won the Liverpool Cup and silver at the East Asian Games. But in terms of achievements, that has to go down as my top achievement. But at the time, I thought it was good, and I was ready for much bigger. And I thought that I could. I went into the Olympics hoping to get a medal, and I didn't know the terrain, the landscape. I didn't know all the guys in my division. I just turned up, and I think there was 4 or 5 world champions in the middleweight division that year. It was a real hot division at the Sydney Olympics, but the Commonwealth Games, I turned up not knowing any of the opponents, any of the division, but I was absolutely expecting. I said, I'm here to win this tournament. I didn't think, oh, maybe I'll get a silver or a medal. I was just like, I'm here to win the tournament. And I was confident. I was a man. I was a bit older. I was 23, you know. At the Olympics, I was just raw and hadn't had that experience. You know, I saw... Harry Garside, he had homework on all of the opponents that he knew them all. He'd done homework, and I just wished that I had that presence of mind and that sort of level of detail in preparation. I'm a huge... if I had to list my favourite fighters, I would say Jai Oppertaia is the best fighter in the country. I just love how he... And he's a gentleman. I met him one time. He's just really... Just good smile, good guy, humble... But tough and skilled, and he's just dynamite. I reckon he's amazing. But I wouldn't say in order of rank, but straight below that, there's this list of fighters that are, some are brand new and some are still just completely amateur and some are veterans. And they're just, my list of fighters would be Harry Garside. I just like him. I think he's a good person.
Yep.
And he's a champion, and I'm just cheering for him and rooting for him. He's Callum Peters. What a gun. I just loved how he fought. Loved his style. I've been meaning, actually, this is was...
He's here at the moment.
He's here in Brisbane.
He trained here today.
Oh, really? So I would come here the at national the drop team of training. Hat and say good. I felt like I had abandoned. I felt like I'd let myself down and let him down. I wanted to write him an email saying, champion, you are on the path to greatness, you know.
Yeah, the national team are training here at the moment.
Oh, wow. I'd love to come and have a look.
Yeah, training camp started today.
Oh, nice. I like him. I like him a lot. And the girls, we could talk about the girls at Caitlin Parker and our veteran senior girl who's just a gun, silver medalist, Kay Scott. Yeah. I like her a lot. Great. You know, she's a leader. But with the men's boxing, it's blurred now, the difference between amateur and professional. It used to be so distinct, but now it's so blurred. So many good guys hopping around at the moment in Australia. It's like we're coming into a golden age just now. I think Jai Oppertaia is the standout. But we've got all these guys on the up and on the down and right at the top level with so many good fighters. Harry Garside and Callum Peters, that's just two. But even in Brisbane, in Queensland, Liam Wilson, like his coach, like they're a great outfit. I haven't seen Vegas Larfield. I haven't seen much of him.
Good operator, yeah. Vegas. Yeah,
yeah. I haven't seen enough of him, but I know if he's running out of that gym, and it looks like he's just enormous potential. I'd like to see some more footage of him.
He just boxed on the weekend.
He fought on the weekend, and he won. He's come up in that amateur system as well. He went pro quite young, but
he went pro young, right? Yeah,
young, but that's very a real choice. Very good base, good skills, and he's young, but he'll learn. Yeah, he's doing really well. Good kid.
Yeah, and Benny Marnie, I met him. Good I man. Chatted with him, and he just
he's a good guy.
Yeah, it can't be like that. You can't pick. I only like that person's music because they're a good person.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I don't want to listen to Michael Jackson because maybe there was those allegations about. Yeah. You know, it's hard to be. Yeah. It's hard to have these hold your fighters that you admire to this standard. But by the same token, I won't walk around in a Floyd Mayweather hat, even though he's you know arguably he's in the conversation for the best ever. But there's too much. too much stuff that I'm like, I'm not wearing that guy's hat. I'm not supporting that dude. There's other people that I'd rather be.
You sound like Gareth Williams, right?
I'm
now.
Exactly the same.
Yeah.
I can't do it.
But not that you have to do a background check of everyone that you want to be a fan of, but that's pretty clear. And I was just like, you know, other people I'd much rather support, like guys that are top fighters, and you know, like, yeah, even yeah, Kambosos.
Yeah.
Just tough and old school.
Mm.
Old school and tough. And yeah, he's got a huge ego, but he's I think he's a gentleman. Self-belief. From what I've heard. Yeah, self-belief. Yeah.
Unbelievable.
But I think he is classy, and I think he's a gentleman. And the way he handled the loss, I that won me over more than anything. More than the win against Teofimo. The way that he handled his loss or his losses, just with class, and that won me over the most.
Yeah.
You know, and I was blown away by the Teofimo win, but the way he managed himself and like that. Yeah, he won me as a fan just based on that alone.
Mate, can I ask you about your professional career?
Yeah.
How that actually came about? I know we spoke before.
It was a professional non-career, really. It was a horrible underachievement. I had 9 professional bouts. I broke my hands in 6 of them. I had broken hands in 6 of the 9 fights. I had cuts in a couple of them. Yeah, it was just I was very injury prone, and it was tricky because I would go to sparring with, say, Danny Green, who's a, you know, great friend of mine and just always been very generous, just a good guy, good person. And I would spar him, and I would hold my own. Definitely. I would, you know, give him, as good as I got. And I think he would say the same. We sparred very hard and very well. And then I would see him, you know, winning the light heavyweight title by stoppage. And then I would, get injured even in training or in a contest. And this is an indictment on me, not an excuse. But I fought down. If you put me in the ring with the Olympic champion, I fought at the Olympic champion level. If you put me in with a lower guy, I often didn't bring out what I needed. The better the opponent, the better I fought.
Mm.
Was how it was for me. I recognize that post career. I look at, you know, where did I fight really well, or where was my best performances generally when I was in with the top guys.
Mate, when it finished, when you called a day on professional boxing.
What are you talking about, Gareth?
Still going?
I haven't retired.
Oh, here we go. The comeback.
I've never retired. I didn't get the privilege. I didn't get the privilege to do it. It just got away from me. I had the worst injury of my life was a tiny little neck injury in my thoracic. Mm. And I slept funny on a pillow and I went to my friend's boxer size fitness class just to support him, not for any reason. And something funny happened to my neck, and 13, 14 years on, still the worst injury that I've ever had, bar none, with all the, you know, broken ribs and knee reconstruction and shoulder reconstruction. It's the worst injury, the most chronic pain that I've ever had. I never quite found the answer. It was in my thoracic. Something just went, something pulled or separated or whatever it was. But I never retired. I would have liked to have had, I could never have had a fight like Floyd Masson. I could never have had a fight like that because he is some sort of alien. That put
brutal.
Him in the conversation for just fighters that you want to watch again. Oh, what an amazing fight. But I would have liked to have had a fight where you're tired and it's round 7 or 8 or 9 or 10 and you just got to dig in and perform. I would have loved to have had a real hard fight as a professional, but I didn't have that. I just had a lot of injuries, and I never had that thing where you got to dig in and search. But I had that experience in the amateurs where over the course of a tournament, you fight a number of fights and you've got broken hand, or you've got, I had lots of injuries at the Commonwealth Games. I had an ankle broken in 2 places, I had a hand. I couldn't make a fist. It was so swollen and had the cut that they wanted to stitch between the semis and the final, but they chose, we ended up deciding not to. So I had that experience of just digging through, you know, finding the way to perform and dig through the difficulty, adversity.
So even though officially you never closed the book on it, there must have been a time when you thought, that's it, I'll never fight again.
Yeah.
And how was that?
Yeah, I think it's that's probably, yeah. I can't even admit this, but I think that's probably come about in the last two years, 1 year.
Really?
Even not, though you not, haven't not fought? Not that I thought that I'd fight at a high level.
Yeah.
But I moved to Australia 3 years ago, after 10 years in America, with my wife, and we've got a, our fourth kid was on the way. We had two in America. We had one when we went over. And our fourth was on the way when we flew back here. And I was 95 kilograms and really lean. I was lifting and really strong. And I just started doing some regular shadow boxing. But when I moved to Australia, I started boxing. And I started this boxing fitness, this magic boxing, this boxing fitness classes. And I went down. At one point, I got down to 78.3. I was within 3.3 of the... I was going to try and make it sentimental and nostalgic. I was going to try and make it 20-year... make my weight after 20 years in 2020. Anyway, that was, it didn't happen for whatever reason. But I was training a lot and I was boxing and I was doing these breathing drills and you know, my resting heart rate was 37 beats a minute. I was in really good shape, right? Mm. Just from training and I felt like I was fast and strong and I thought, I'm good enough to come back and not fight at any high level, but just fight at a domestic, a Queensland or even an Australian professional title level. I thought that, and that's silly thinking and it's self-deception, all that sort of stuff, but I just had it in my head that I can still do that. I'm young. I've always been pretty respectful of how I manage myself and my health and fitness, and I was doing this training and I was doing 12 or hard rounds on the bag, pretty hard pace, no sparring. But that's the common curse, all boxers, right? Thinking that, and it's terrible. And it's no one, maybe just for a seniors competition, a masters thing might have been fun, but I wouldn't want to have done that against someone not so good. So I kept thinking, I'll just aim for a Queensland title at 42, 43. That'd be exciting and fun. And you see, you know, B-Hop and, you know, Hopkins and these guys doing it. But he's been in the game the whole time and he came in late. But I also recognise that is self-deception. That's what happens to a lot of boxers. And anyway, I recognise that even in the last year that was just not the right thing. And I've got a responsibility. I've got a family. I've got the kids. I've got a really good life. And boxing, it gave me so much, but I put a lot into it. And I didn't get what I got out of it wasn't financial. I got a confidence in life. It just gave me a confidence and it gave me, just confidence and so many experiences and travel the world and gave me all this stuff, but it didn't give me, say, I think Jamie Pittman might have got a house out of it with the German fight. Geely would have, you know, made some money. Greeny's made a ton of money. Respectfully, he's made some money.
Yeah, yeah.
But I didn't get that, but I got other things out of it. So, I know now that boxing, without any question, I wouldn't even spar.
Mm.
Although I'm tempted just to do touch sparring and, you know, but even that is unnecessary at this stage in your life.
Would you move into coaching eventually, Paul? I know you touched on it before.
Yeah, I'd like to. I've got 6 years up my sleeve before I head into coaching athletes. Mm-hmm. 6 years too. I'm focused on this. You know, we've got this swim center, Ascot Aquatic Center in Ascot, Brisbane, and I got a couple of little businesses that I'm working really hard on, trying to build that up. So that takes precedence. And then I think coming into the game, just with some maturity, and hopefully, I think you go into it not looking to make millions. You go into it looking for an adventure and working with elite athletes. That would be cool.
I know, like you've said before, some of your greatest or fondest memories of boxing is coaching the kid to have their first fight. Yeah. You know, it's the passion. It's not the... You're not making any money out of a kid having their first fight, are you? So
yeah, I trained a fella in Sydney, Alex McClintock, and just a great guy. And he had a fight, and I think he won it, and he had another fight, and I think he lost it. I can't remember that. But anyway, he won the New South Wales novice middleweight title, and it was just awesome. I was so happy for him, and he wrote a book. And the title of the book escapes me right now, but it was a really, really funny delve into Australian boxing and boxing history and his experience with fighting. Just escapes me what the name of the title of that book is right now, but Alex McClintock's the author. If anyone wants to go and read a bloody funny, good Australian boxing book, that's one.
Yeah. Wait, so tell me this. Fast forward 6 years. What is Paul Miller, the coach, like? Who is that guy?
I'm developing. I watch a lot of boxing now. I just love it. I love it more now, as much now as I've ever liked it. I think I would love to work with elite athletes. I would love to do that. I think I know boxing really well. I think I can analyze fighters well. I always would lean towards the boxing purist rather than the aggressive fighter, but I still think that I would work really well with coaching an aggressive pressure fighter. You know, this guy is sublime and he has skill, Tim Zhu. But he's, you know, boil it down and he's a pressure fighter. Just incredible pressure, but he's just excellent skills. I was blown away with that last fight that he did. I was really impressed.
Oh, he was excellent. Yeah.
Really impressed, and I like his coach a lot. He was my coach, Eagle. I'm excited. It's fun to be a fan and to have an understanding of the sport and to watch these fights. And you know that was my old coach, Eagle, and I'm just thrilled for him. I'm as much thrilled for Eagle as I am for Tim.
Yeah.
You know, I'm seeing him evolve and become this outstanding, high-achieving coach. It's cool to watch, you know?
Yeah. You've done a bit of work with Tim, Jack.
Yeah, he's incredible. Very sharp eye, good hand-eye coordination, and he's strong. You know, very very staunch as well, you know, very solid in what he does, and he's composed. Man, he's got the world at his feet, and, yeah, it's exciting to watch him.
Like you said, a pressure fighter. Yeah, he's, I think, put the two thoughts together. He's a composed pressure fighter.
Oh, yeah.
He's got composure. You're never far from an arm's length away from him. One error, you're getting hit.
There's nothing. It's
strong and staunch. And
it's like...
Doesn't make extra movement. Doesn't wind anything up. Everything's just direct.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm super impressed. He's fun to watch. Mm. You know, it's you know, it sometimes you'll watch a pressure fighter and it's not boring, but it's smothering and it's messy.
Yeah.
You know, this is every shot, even if it's not a knockout shot, it's crisp and it's clean and it's nice to watch.
Yeah, he's very accurate.
Mm.
Excellent. All good, Jacko?
I'm good, mate. Yeah. Mate. I would like to pick your brain after the podcast. You can show me a few of those jab tutorial sessions.
Oh yeah, mate. Yeah. You know, I've got this one of the drills in the classes. You'll throw 20 jabs or 30 jabs, and they've all got to be different iterations, different variations, and leaning in, leaning out, falling across. You know, zipping it up, crashing it down. All sorts of just subtle little. You know, doing it where you avert your eyes and then shooting at the target, looking off to the, you know, looking off at the referee and shooting, just constantly making variations with the front hand. But when we talk about, when I was talking about top fighters, Jack, where are we at? You're in the list. You're at the top of the list.
No, thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, I believe I'm up there with one of Australia's best. It's just, you know, coming off a loss. And look, I know you probably wouldn't even really want this out there, but after I lost, Paul sent me a really nice message. And, you know, when you hear it from people, like I looked up to you as well as a lot of people that have been in the amateurs before me. When I was an amateur, I remember being at the AIS and they had this wall of plaques. I don't know if you've seen it in the combat center.
All the medal winners.
All the medal winners. And my favorite amateur boxer ever was Damien Hooper. And Damien was on there. You were on there. I know Ben McGeckran for
Ben
bronze.
Ben McGeckran, yes, is my teammate.
Yes, and obviously Jared Fletcher and like yes. Geely, all these names, and you were one of them. And, you know, to hear you send me that nice message was just, I know it was nice for me in a moment where I felt really down. And I don't do it for people that are, you know, general fans. I do it for people that I looked up to, you know, and to hear that meant a lot to me. And yeah, I would like to pick your brain after this. But yeah, I appreciate you putting me in one of your top fighters, mate. Yeah, means a lot.
Yeah, of course. You know what else is interesting just at the moment? We're probably going to wrap this up, right? You know what else is interesting at the moment with Australian boxing? It's following fighters, but it's following coaches too. Mm. You know, it's you know, you see this guy, Benny Harrington, and he's taking these kids down to a tournament and they've got, you know, 10 kids in the tournament and 10 kids win the tournament. Or I think just recently he had a whole bunch of kids in the tournament and I think only one of them won. And I was like, oh, that's very unusual for him. That we might have just on the weekend passed. But
yeah,
he's working with kids and he's working with Liam Wilson, who's just, you know, dynamite. He's just done so well. And then seeing, coaches, you know, developing a team. You've got a team here. Mm. That's unusual to have a squad, you know.
It's when you say a squad, we're currently about to order new uniforms for all our amateur team.
Right. Yeah, it's plenty
of
them.
And I thought, oh, I'll get 30. That'll be heaps. So I counted them up.
Yeah.
We need 40 tracksuits.
Gee whiz. It's a crew. Whether it, you need a bus.
I know.
Greyhound.
But, but it's like, you know, like we separate them all, like beginners and guys that are a bit more experienced, and then adults, and then and then you bring them all together, and there's quite a few. But
I'm excited to see Tara Moana develop, just unlimited potential. It's fun to be around now. We've got this, you know, Justice Hooney. Just interesting to see a heavyweight with potentially, you know, everything achievable within his reach. It's exciting, you know.
It's crazy how good Queensland boxing's always been, you know, here in the teams you were amongst. And then now it's still Queensland boxing's, I believe, it's the best in the country.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think so.
Amateurs all the way to pros. There's so much depth just in our state.
Well, it's true. And like you mentioned Alan Nicholson before, Alan had a big input into that.
He did.
What Alan used to do, he used to take state teams all over the place. And
yeah, they did trips to
whether
Russia.
You were national level, you still had development opportunities international. Mm. And you know yourself and Jack as well, when you go internationally, whether you're in a B team, a C team, you come back a little bit better. No matter what happened over there, you come back better.
Much
just
better.
Confidence. You can't even explain your development, but you just come back better.
Yeah. And yeah, you know what, where you are right now in your career, it's, you know, my son just had the Queensland Gymnastics Championships on the weekend and he finished, it's his first state championships because he missed last year. He broke a bone. He had two rods put in his hand. So he missed the state. So this year was his first state championships, in Australia. And he finished the first day and he was fifth overall and he'd had a fall on this apparatus that he doesn't usually fall on. And he just had to, you know, this is what I love about boxing and gymnastics or any sport. He had to just do so much, not soul searching, but he had to just regroup and then pick himself up and go again. That's where you are right now. You're just regrouping, and I think you've done the regrouping. Now you're just waiting for the chance to go again.
Yeah, 100%. And we fixed those little things, but I think that's like a full circle thing. Listening to your story, you know, getting picked in the B spot, then you take boxing. I missed out on a state AFL team. That's why I got into boxing.
Oh, AFL,
you know,
yeah.
you have that little setback and then you bounce back and look what can happen.
Yeah.
It's unreal. Mm.
All right. Let's wrap this up.
Let's wrap this up.
Mate, Paul Miller, so privileged to have you on the show. You're a good man. And I think afterwards we need to chat. You come and have a chat with the national team. There,
I want to see some of these guys move around.
Some of the sparring sessions when Jack's sparring next time.
I would love to watch this amateur team moving around as well.
Yeah, it'd be excellent.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, thanks for having me. A pleasure to be here. It's just talking about boxing. I can do it all day. I love talking about boxing.
Excellent. Thank you very much, guys. Paul.
Cheers. Thank you.
Good man.